Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with journalist Mark Gunther about his new piece in Sierra Magazine called Warren Buffett's Coal Problem. We'll also talk with Avital Andrews to get some tips for yummy, eco-friendly dips and spreads. And author Tim Gallagher will join us to talk about his book, Imperial Dreams, tracking the imperial woodpecker through the wild Sierra Madre. Joining us now over the phone is Mark Gunther. He's a contributing editor at Fortune Magazine and author of a recent piece in Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Orly.
So, Mark, let's talk a little bit about this piece that you've written for Sierra Magazine. What drew you to the story, and tell our listeners a little bit about what it covered?
Well, what drew me to the story was really the fact that we had two billionaires. Warren Buffett is one of them. Forrest Mars, the heir to the Mars candy fortune, is the other, who joined up with the country's second biggest coal company, Arch Coal, to try to build a relatively short stretch of railroad in Montana. I believe it's about 40 miles long, maybe less, but it's vital to get coal out of the ground in southeast Montana, which will then make its way to the West Coast and ultimately to China. And as a reporter who covers business and the environment, I get a lot of gray stories where companies are doing some good things and some bad things, and there are a lot of issues that are highly complicated to think about. I'm thinking about things like nuclear power and GMOs as examples. This was one of those rare black and white stories, at least from where I sat, where we don't need the coal, we don't need the railroad, it's going to disrupt life for ranchers and Native Americans and others living in this remote part of the country that no one pays attention to, and here you have two billionaires who want to put in a railroad to get coal out of the ground and send it to China.
You know, I'm really interested in the Buffett angle here. You know, the article talks about Buffett's coal problem. And Berkshire Hathaway seems to be going both ways. Some of their companies are moving away from coal and others are digging in. What do you think is going on here?
I think Berkshire Hathaway is a very decentralized company, fundamentally. Warren Buffett buys a lot of assets. He tends to leave the managers in place to run them, and that accounts for what might seem to be contradictory positions. So I actually wrote a cover story for Fortune some years ago about his investment in BYD, an electric car company in China that's also doing some great work around solar panels for homes and batteries and has a very green vision of the future. On the other hand, Buffett owns the BNSF, Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railroad. Coal is about 25% of their business, and they are the ones who are trying to build this railroad in Montana. His big energy company in the Midwest and Far West, which is called Mid-American Energy Holdings, has done some great things with solar and wind, but they too are pretty heavily invested in the coal industry. So it's not a simple story when you talk about Buffett, but it seems to me he can be held accountable for at least this, which is he has spoken up on lots of big issues in America. Taxation very prominently, the financial crisis a few years ago, he had strong ideas about righting the economy and then sending it back into health. And he's been very silent on climate. He's missed the opportunity to talk. And so I think it's fair to say, you know, where do you stand, Mr. Buffett? And why do you want to dig this coal out of the ground in Montana?
The other thing that I find really interesting about Warren Buffett in this case is that he's made so much news about his plans to donate most of his fortune to philanthropic causes. And, you know, his legacy seems to be very important to him. And I'm wondering if you've seen any indication that he might be considering, you know, how his holdings in the coal industry could worsen climate disruption and how that could do damage to his legacy.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually something thought a lot about. That's my impression, both from reading some transcripts of these annual meetings of Berkshire Hathaway that they have every year in Omaha in a huge sports stadium where financial reporters from all over the world cover it. His comments seem very off the cuff. In defense of the railroad, yes, they carry a lot of coal, but they're a common carrier. They basically will carry anything anyone pays them to carry. So you can't quite fault him for owning a railroad that depends on coal. But again, his silence on the climate issue, the fact that the railroad has lobbied heavily against any form of regulation of coal in Washington, the fact that his railroad is pushing hard for these ports in the Northwest, in the public policy arena where Buffett has tremendous influence because he is so widely admired and respected, that's where I think he has fallen down or sort of failed to live up to his reputation as a public-spirited businessman.
Now, aside from climate disruption, there are a lot of reasons why people personally object to the impact of coal in their daily lives, you know, especially in the places where it's being mined and transported. So I'm wondering, what were some of the issues that came up as you were researching the story?
Well, interestingly, this is Montana. It's not really a super conservative state. I mean, they have a Democratic senator, so it goes red or blue. But this corner of Montana in the southeast near Billings is quite conservative. So the ranchers who are unhappy about the railroad, some of them do not believe in climate change, but they've been living there a long time. Most of the ones I spoke to, their families have been ranching in Montana since the end of the 19th century, more than 100 years. And they basically object to the idea that the railroad and the coal company can come in and disrupt the way of life that they and their families have lived for a long time and that they're hoping to live in the future. The other little twist to the story is that if the railroad is approved, and there's some doubt about that, there's battles both at the state and federal level, Buffett and Mr. Mars, who's the other owner of the railroad, and the Arch Coal Company, which also owns a stake in this rail spur, would be able to use the power of eminent domain, a government power, essentially to force the landowners to sell their land. They'd get paid for it, but they couldn't simply say, no, this is my land, there's no price at which I want to sell because I want to continue to do what I've done for years and pass it along to my children.
Now let's talk just for a minute about MidAmerican. You know, they've become one of the country's top investors in renewable energy, and they recently reached this agreement with the Sierra Club to retire several of the coal-fired plants, the power plants in their fleet. What kind of economic calculus do you think is going on over at MidAmerican right now on coal?
I think the calculus at MidAmerican is purely financial. In other words, we'll play by whatever rules the government tells us to play by. So, as you noted, they've invested very heavily in wind in Iowa. More recently, they've invested heavily in both solar in both Southern California and in Arizona. And essentially, that's because those states, those localities, plus the federal government have set up policies that make those good investments, some subsidies for solar and a state standard that requires utilities to buy wind power or other forms of renewable energy in Iowa. Having said that, in places where the laws are not renewable-friendly and more coal-friendly, they continue to operate coal plants, including one in Montana that I believe is, if not the dirtiest, one of the two dirtiest coal plants in the West. So I think it's purely a business calculus. I don't think they have a point of view, really, on the environment at all. And again, that's where things get gray. Their job is to work for their shareholders and play by the rules. You know, it's hard to fault them if coal is cheaper and we aren't putting any kind of price on carbon if they continue to burn coal. The problem is Buffett in the public policy arena and MidAmerican in the public policy arena have influenced the laws so as to oppose the proper kind of regulation, or what you and I would see as the proper kind of regulation of coal plants.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
I think this story, and I hope people do have a chance to read it, is really a reminder of how power works in the U.S. in the broadest scale. You have a railroad, a coal company, and two millionaires going up against folks who really don't have a voice and really don't have a power. And to me, it was just striking the difficult struggle that faces these ranchers, the Native Americans, and even a group of Amish farmers who settled in the area. They're getting some help from Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, and other environmental groups, but boy, it's very tough to go to battle against the kind of resources that Buffett and Forrest Mars and Arch Coal bring to bear.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Mark Gunther, contributing editor for Fortune Magazine, and also the author of a new piece in the current issue of Sierra Magazine, which you can find online at sierramagazine.com. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
Hi, really good to be here.
It's great to have you back.
Thanks.
Today, we're going to talk about this new piece that you have in the May-June issue of Sierra Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You've gotten a reputation at Sierra Magazine for always doing these different pieces where you compare different eco foods.
I know
you did one on different eco ice creams and mm-hmm. one on different granolas, right?
Beer, fast
trail
food,
mix.
All the fun stuff.
So
yeah.
Now we're looking at this issue of the magazine with a piece called Schmear Campaign, talking about different eco or green, different spreads and dips that
mm-hmm.
you can have.
Yeah. Yeah, this was sort of a tough one for me to define because, you know, when you say dips, that doesn't come to mind immediately. But my first thought was nut butters because that's a really popular category. And then I sort of expanded because hummus is a huge category now. So I just figured dips and spreads that you can put on crackers and breads, if you can sort of imagine that. We've got a great photo spread that illustrates it in the magazine. But
so what were some of the best tasting things that you picked and why were they green?
So like I said, I started with the idea of looking into peanut butters or nut butters. I had learned that more than 800 peanuts go into one 18-ounce jar of peanut butter. So if you, that's like so many peanuts, which, you know, if they're not organic and if it's done wastefully, it's not good. So the amount of peanut butter and nut butters that we Americans consume is a lot. So I wanted to find one that is eco-friendly. And one brand really jumped out. The brand's called Justin's. You might have heard of it. It's sold in Target. It's a really big brand, actually. Their best tasting product is called honey almond butter. And it's really smooth and sweet, and it goes perfectly on everything from rice cake to banana. It's high protein, which is good for us vegetarians. It's GMO-free, meaning it has no genetically modified ingredients. It comes in a jar that's recycled plastic and, of course, recyclable as well. The only ingredients in it are California-grown almonds, sugar, honey, sea salt, and palm oil. And palm oil usually should raise a red flag if you hear that or see that on a jar, but this particular palm oil was sourced from a sustainable farm as opposed to a clear-cut forest in Indonesia, which palm oil often is.
Let's talk about in the hummus category,
because
that's great for snacking.
Yeah.
What did you find that was unusual, tasty, and also eco?
Yeah, so there's a brand called Eat Well, Enjoy Life, which I love that name. It's sort of a long name, but, you know, makes me happy. And their best product that I could determine was the sweet and spicy black bean hummus. It comes with corn, pineapple, red peppers, pecans, chipotle chilies, and this medley of spices. It's really good, especially if you like black beans.
And what made it green or eco?
So this is also GMO-free, no genetically modified ingredients. The packaging is not recycled, unfortunately, but it's made of a highly recyclable plastic. I don't generally like to promote recyclable because a lot of stuff's recyclable, but it is. It's highly recyclable. And one really fun thing is it's a paperless company. So Eat Well, Enjoy Life recycles all their waste and is completely paperless.
Well, we have time for one more. I was interested in the sesame butter that you reviewed. What does that taste like and what should our listeners know about it?
Yeah, this is a really interesting product. It's called Premium Organic Sesame Butter. It's from a company called Golden Millstone. And it's made from just one ingredient. They're sesame seeds harvested from small organic farms in Ethiopia with workers who are treated in a fair trade way. And the sesame seeds are slow roasted at temperatures that are low enough to keep this a raw food. And then they're ground on a 90-year-old millstone, hence the brand name. And it just tastes really nutty. If you've had tahini, basically, that's what tahini is, and it's just this really delicious, nutty-tasting, nutrient-dense butter that, you know, you can put really on anything.
Well, I should also add before we wrap up that one of the fun things about this piece is that you add a way for people to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, the greenest thing of all is to make things at home and not have to buy something with packaging.
So
They have a great recipe here for carrot cashew miso spread from a James Beard nominated chef.
Yeah. She was kind enough to let us reprint a version of her recipe, and it's amazing. It's if you see the picture in the magazine, it's this bright orange and the flavor is just as lively. It's this really great recipe, and we are trying to include DIY recipes in all of our food pieces because it really is the greenest way to go. It's local. You don't have to deal with packaging. You can store it in your freezer and just as much as you can make food yourself.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine. Tim Gallagher joins us today. He's the author of Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. Welcome.
Great to be here.
I wanted to start by talking about something that preceded this book. About a decade ago, you rediscovered the legendary ivory-billed woodpecker, and most scientists had believed it had been extinct for about 60 years. And when you did this, it caused an international stir. I'm wondering if you could tell us more about that.
It has been controversial ever since we brought out word of the discovery, and we showed a videotape that one of our people, David Leneau, had taken, and we analyzed it. And we wrote an article in the journal Science. You know, it has been controversial because it was a very poor quality video. So we wrote about that and seven of the sightings we'd had. We'd had a total of about 16 sightings.
What was it like to be the person who rediscovered a bird that had been said to be extinct?
Well, it was one of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me. And I went into it not knowing something like that would happen. I thought in the beginning when I was working on that project that the bird was extinct, but I wanted to find all the people who remembered the bird from the 1930s and early 40s and interview them and see what they had to say about the bird, because if indeed the bird was extinct, this is our last living connection with the bird. And in 10 or 20 years, you wouldn't be able to ask these people the questions anymore. But in the course of that, traveling around the South and interviewing people, many of whom were in their 80s, 90s, and even one man was 99 years old, I found people who claimed much more recent sightings. Sometimes I didn't even know it was an ivory bill, but, you know, hunters and people like that would describe a bird that fit the description, and they seemed honest, so I started checking out these sightings. In the course of that, a lot of these sightings were from the 1950s and quite a while ago, but we found a kayaker, Gene Sparling, who'd had a sighting of a bird that sounded just like an ivory-billed woodpecker just 6 days earlier. So my friend Bobby Harrison and I, we went to Arkansas to Bayou de Vieux, and we were going to spend a week floating the bayou. And on the second day, we had an ivory-bill fly in front of us and swoop up to land on a tupelo. You know, we said, ivory bill, and the bird just panicked and flew away through the woods. And after that, it was madness, you know, going over to the side of the bayou and jumping out and waist-deep water and mud and ripping our clothes, going over, you know, falling line. And we were almost in cardiac arrest, and Bobby was crying. Like, he'd been trying to see an ivory bill for 33 years, and I'd been like that myself for just about as long. And it was an indescribable moment.
What first drove you to study birds? What is it about them that you find magical or that drives you to really do this work?
You know, it's hard to say what originally gets people interested in things, because I can remember as, I don't know, a 3 or 4 year old boy when I was living with my grandmother for a little while in England and, you know, going out and trying to talk to birds out in the backyard. And later, when I was 6 years old, I trained a parakeet, and then I had pigeons, and then later, I was a falconer when I was just in my teens, and I was really fascinated by birds, especially birds of prey. They've always been my specialty, but also these large woodpeckers have the same kind of fascination for me as birds of prey do.
Now, your new book is about a journey that you took into the heart of the Mexican Sierra Madre to study another of the world's rarest birds, also a woodpecker, this time the imperial woodpecker. And I read that before your travels, the last confirmed sighting of one of these birds was in the 1950s. So what made you decide to pursue the imperial woodpecker, and what is it about them that you find so special?
Well, as far as we know from the fossil record, they're the biggest woodpecker that ever lived. They're the closest relative of an ivory bill, look very similar to them, only they're much bigger. They're more than 20% bigger. They're 2 feet in length. You know, I mean, they're the size of a raven. And They're just an incredible bird, but very little studied. You know, hardly anyone ever went down there and studied them. You know, no, there isn't even a still photograph of one, a living one, or no one's ever recorded the sound of their vocalizations or their drumming. And the only photographic documentation of any kind was one we found out about, a man, a Pennsylvania dentist who went down there in 1956 and took a short film of one that had a lot of interesting behaviors in it. But so this was a bird that, you know, maybe disappeared before we even got to know it. But at the same time, you know, when you say the last certain sighting was in the 50s, you certainly, when you go around the Sierra, you'll find people who can describe a bird that looks like it, you know, in these remote areas. You know, the Indians and people like that who are up in the high country. And it is a very remote area, and it's hard to look around, especially now that a lot of the area is kind of overrun with drug growers. So it's very dangerous. So it's hard to be certain the bird's extinct.
I wanted to talk with you more, actually, about the issues of drug trafficking in this region. It's become a very dangerous place. Tell us more about your experiences there and your, some of the run-ins that you had.
Well, it seemed like I went on five expeditions up there, and every time it seemed like it was 100 times worse. You know, I'd been meaning to go several years earlier, and Mexican friends had told me, oh, it's really bad right now, don't go. Wait a year and see how it is. And every time I waited, it got worse and worse. Finally, I decided I've got to go now. But, you know, we had some really pretty awful times. We were trying to figure out the area where that man had taken the film in 1956, and we knew approximately where it was, and we looked on Google Earth, and we actually found some places that were on these steep-sided mesas that had uncut forest on top. And we thought, well, that'd be a good place to look. So we went down there, and my friend Marchand Lamartink, who's a woodpecker researcher, he knew a forester down there who knew some of the people up there, including some drug growers. And he arranged a meeting, and they were going to help us get up to their area, although on the way there, we had to go through some hostile areas, and then they said we couldn't look on the other side of this river, the Taxicaringa River, because the Setas were in charge on that side, who were these paramilitaries. They're the worst cartel. So it was very constrained what we can do. But even before we could go, that night, you know, someone called a death threat to the forester, you know, anonymous death threat. So, and then we're driving up the next day, and some people drove past us. And it's really terrible roads, 5-hour trip just to go, you know, 50 or 60 miles. I mean, they're so bad. And, you know, they came by with AK-47s. And later a villager got kidnapped and held for ransom in the village, you know, a couple of miles from where we were staying. So awful things were happening. And then the people who were supposed to try to help us get out of there again didn't show up. So,
did you ever wonder, you know, whether it was worth risking your life in order to be able to tell the story of this bird?
You know, you don't think about things like that, or you won't ever do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a point at which we had to meet these people in the park at midnight after, and there'd been, someone had shot a rocket-propelled grenade at a hotel earlier in Durango, and, you know, we could hear the explosion from it, and there were lots of police and military people around, and we had to meet these guys, and then they were saying, well, we shouldn't go. But I was so excited about seeing those areas, those mesas that were almost like little lost worlds, you know. It probably wasn't smart. I should have dropped out, because some of the other researchers, some of the Mexican scientists dropped out at that point. And I just thought, well, I knew that I'd never in my lifetime, I mean, no one would go up there again. This was like a last chance deal, and I really wanted to see that area. And I mean, but in retrospect, it wasn't worth it. We came very close to, you know, having a disaster.
You know, for our listeners who in their lifetimes will probably never see, you know, an imperial woodpecker, why should they care about endangered species? What is it that we lose when we lose a magnificent species like this?
Well, there's no other bird like the imperial woodpecker, and you know, never will be. And the area it's from, that beautiful mesa forest, old growth pines, it's such a beautiful area. And a lot of it's already been destroyed, and they've already wiped out the grizzly bears and the Mexican wolf, and now if the imperial's gone. And you know, they had extermination campaigns against the Apaches. They were still having wars with the Apaches into the 1930s in those mountains, the ones who didn't surrender with Geronimo. So it's quite quite an amazing place. It's always been very violent and difficult to govern, even going back to the Spanish and the Aztecs even.
What other message would you want to bring to our listeners about your journey and your book and your work?
Well, I want to bring people's attention to the importance of some of these habitats that have been neglected. I mean, that was a big thing with the ivory-billed woodpecker. The southern bottomland swamps forests, you know, that's one of the most neglected habitats in North America that was logged and logged. And even in, you know, in the 1970s, when the price of soybeans went up sky high, they were just bulldozing down those forests, you know, that were the primary habitat of ivory bills, and, you know, just clearing them and putting in soybeans. And I mean, so the habitat is everything. Like Aldo Leopold said, the land is an organism, you know. It's like everything is part of it, the animals, the plants, and, you know, and we need to save that. And it's good for people. You know, it's not just some aesthetic thing, knowing that it's there. I mean, it's the planet needs these areas.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Tim Gallagher, the author of Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Welcome to a special arts and science edition of Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, and that's Sun Rings, composed by Terry Riley and performed by the world-renowned Kronos Quartet. We'll talk with the musicians about this magnificent work that features sound recordings from the cosmos, provided by planetary scientist Don Gurnett. But we'll also hear from Bill Nye, reporting from Washington, D.C., and we'll pay a What's Up visit to Bruce Betts, who will help me determine which of you out there is going to have the Science Guy greeting callers to his or her voicemail. We begin with Planetary Society Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla. Hey, Emily, great to catch you just before you leave for this trip to Washington that Bill Nye is going to tell us about in a second. But let's talk about this May 9th entry in the blog. And the first thing that I thought when I saw it was, oh my gosh, that Chinese lunar lander is huge.
It's absolutely enormous. It's one of actually two landers that they're building, the same way that they did with Chang'e 1 and eventually Chang'e 2. They're building two spacecraft. Their nominal mission is to launch and land one on the lunar surface to do various kinds of sampling. And they're also going to deploy an opportunity-sized rover onto the surface from the top of the lander. But they got a second one, so they're probably going to launch the second one, assuming the first one works well. And they'll wind up with two lunar landers. This is Chang'e 3 and Chang'e 4. Chang'e 3 is supposed to launch in December currently, but since it's a lunar mission, they're pretty flexible as to the launch date. And I don't know when Chang'e 4 is supposed to launch. But these two are going to pave the way for their next mission after this is going to be automated lunar sample returns. So the Chinese really have a pretty amazing lunar program going on right now.
And if you look at these images on this May 9 entry in Emily's blog at planetary.org, you will see this large rover sitting on top of this much larger base in a gigantic vacuum chamber that could obviously...
That's right.
Go ahead. I was going to say, it looks like it could hold something a lot bigger, too.
It could hold something a lot bigger. Maybe even something large enough to carry humans to the lunar surface.
Yes. In fact, you speculate about that in this blog entry, and so do some other people who comment on what you've written.
Yeah, that's just speculation at this point, but it's really hard to imagine that that's not where they're headed, considering that they've also got space station and Earth orbit and stuff going on right now. So they seem to have a pretty clear goal with this program.
Well, the photos are great if you can ignore the incredibly
obnoxious watermarks that the Chinese, apparently a Chinese magazine, put over these images. But they are well worth looking at. They will knock your socks off. And NASA, I hope you're taking notice. Do indeed have a great time in D.C. with others of our colleagues there. And we'll turn to Bill in a second to hear more about what's going to be going on. Thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
She is the senior editor for the Planetary Society and our planetary evangelist, headed for D.C. now to do some advocacy work and also meet some members of the public there, particularly members of the Planetary Society. You can also see her work as a contributing editor in Sky and Telescope magazine. As promised, here is the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye. Welcome, Bill. Tell us why we're talking to you on a cell phone in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm going between meetings. The Planetary Society is holding a lunch and learn to once again communicate to Congress, and especially Congress members' staffers, the importance of planetary science, what a great value it is, and how it enriches our society, moves us forward technologically, makes discoveries that change the world. And yet, there are people who want to cut the budget, $200 million, when it would be much more appropriate, in our opinion, to keep it at the level it was back in 2012. And Matt, it's this thing where one set of congressmen set it up this way, then the Office of Management and Budget cuts it down. The Office of Science and Technology restores it. Then they get cut down. Then the Congress passes another thing. This has to do with the sequester, appropriations, and the authorizations committees. It is just a complicated mess. And if you want to find out the details, check out planetary.org and read Casey Dreyer's blog. Casey, who's our political analyst, Jen Vaughn, the COO, and I are going to visit several Congress people tomorrow. And then we're going to have a lunch and learn where we try to change the world.
We already heard that Emily Lakdawalla is joining you for a couple of days as well.
Yes, and Bobak Ferdowsi, the Mohawk man. Bobak Ferdowsi, the Mohawk man.
That and free food for these Congress members and their staffs, I hope we'll pull in a nice crowd.
Oh, yes. There's nothing like a boxed lunch in the Rayburn Building. No, but, Matt, this is what the Planetary Society does. We are working to influence space policy. So I'll give you an update next week.
Thank you, Bill. Give them hell.
Thank you, Matt.
He's the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. We'll be right back with the Kronos Quartet and Sun Rings in just a moment.
Earth Chorus.
That was planetary scientist and space sound discoverer Don Gurnett of the University of Iowa. We featured Don and his eerie yet captivating collection back in June of 2011. Here's another selection from his library.
Jovian electron cyclotron emissions.
Don did not suspect when he began collecting his cosmic audio signatures that they would one day both inspire and become part of an amazing musical composition that would be performed throughout the world by the Kronos Quartet. Last March, the quartet brought Sun Rings to the Carpenter Performing Arts Center at California State University, Long Beach, in Southern California. I was invited to moderate a conversation with the quartet just a day before the multimedia concert. What you are about to hear are excerpts from that fascinating, more than an hour-long conversation with Kronos founder and violinist David Harrington, violinist John Sherba, violist Hank Dutt, and cellist Jeffrey Ziegler. We were also joined by CSU Long Beach's Area Director of Composition and Music Theory, Dr. Alan Shockley. The complete discussion is on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. I began with this question for David Harrington. Can you talk about the genesis of this piece, Sun Rings? I mean, did you ever think that you would get a call from NASA?
No, I did not ever think Kronos would get a call. And what happened was that I got a call from Janet Calperthwaite, our manager, and she said, I just heard from the arts program director at NASA, and his question was, would Kronos be interested in including some of the sounds recorded on the Voyager expeditions in any of their concerts? It didn't take me a tenth of a second to say, well, I didn't know there were any sounds. But if there are, or were, or if they're available, I need to hear them right away. And so by the time we got back from that tour, there was a little, believe it or not, from NASA, a cassette. And this was in 2000. So I put it on, and all of a sudden here I am hearing something that sounded like nature to me, but not like a nature that I'd ever heard before.
Like many before him, David was utterly captivated, and he immediately saw the opportunity presented by Don Granette's sounds. He turned to a composer who had collaborated with the Kronos Quartet for many years, a man known as the father of the minimalist movement in music.
And that was Terry Riley. But what I really wanted to do was see his face when I played the sounds for him. And then I would know for sure if this was going to work. And so there was a moment at one of our recording sessions, and I had the opportunity to introduce Terry to these sounds. It was instantaneous, the desire to somehow find a way of bringing these sounds and space into this piece, into a piece. He began to have this idea of making this piece that would kind of celebrate everything out there. And then September 11th happened, 2001. And then September 12th happened. And on the radio on September 12th on KPFA, one of our great poets, Alice Walker, was chanting over and over again, one earth, one people, one love. And Terry heard that. And shortly after that, I got a call from Terry, and he said that he began to rethink the whole piece and that it was going to take a different form.
Riley's new concept of the piece would place great demands on the talents of the quartet's musicians, as well as on anyone who chose to stage the piece. An 80-voice choir, complex multimedia and lighting, and Don Granette's sounds of space triggered by the quartet's hands moving over sensors. Granette became an active partner in the project, along with famed stage and lighting designer Willie Williams.
Don Granette, Willie Williams, Kronos, Terry Riley, and then the University of Iowa heard about it, and they have a great choir program. So everything began to kind of take shape, and that's where the piece came from. And I'll add to that, both Terry and I visited Don's studio laboratory, and each of us had 6 or 8 hours with Don Granette, and both of us had exactly the same feeling, that by the end of that 6 or 8 hours of talking to Don, we felt we could explain the universe to our our loved ones. And so I called up my wife and I said, you know, I just had this amazing experience with Don Granette, and he was telling me all about space, and I couldn't remember a damn thing he said. And Terry had exactly the same experience. That moment with Don, those moments with Don, it enlarges your mind, and for an instant you feel like you kind of get it. Hmm. But then to be able to describe it to anybody else, it vanishes so quickly that you're speechless. And that's what happened.
Almost sounds like trying to describe a transcendent artistic experience.
I think that's perhaps the connection that we're ultimately talking about. He spent the whole day just exactly like that, and he'd say, and Whistler's, and he'd do the thing. You know, he's a musician. He uses sound all the time. I mean, he's a wonderful person, and he makes these mysteries so tangible and real and fun.
David Harrington of the Kronos Quartet talking about the creation of Sun Rings, a composition that includes the space sounds collected by planetary scientist Don Granette from our own planet and others in our solar system. We'll continue the conversation after a break. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from Planet Fest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from, and are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do, and together we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the worlds.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. This week we're at the intersection of art and science, two disciplines that have more in common than many imagine. We're going to return to California State University, Long Beach, for more of my conversation last March with the Kronos Quartet. Kronos came to the university to perform Terry Riley's Sun Rings, an evocative piece that incorporates sounds drawn from natural phenomena throughout our solar system, and collected by Don Gurnett of the University of Iowa. I tell you to go buy a recording of Sun Rings, but I can't. More than 10 years after its premiere, Kronos has still not recorded it, largely because when they do, they want to get it right.
But you say it should be a DVD or maybe a Blu-ray because the visual elements are so important to the piece?
Yeah, and all the behind-the-scenes stuff. I mean, like our crew is over there right now getting this piece going. And then, of course, this evening we're going to be rehearsing with the choir. And there's just all sorts of things that need to be known. And then the Jet Propulsion Lab provided all kinds of things for us. And I remember the day I went down there. And then Terry and I went to a launch. I was not expecting the feeling that I had. I mean, not only does the Earth literally rumble and the alligators come up and the birds fly away and all that, but as a person, as a father, as a husband, as a sentient being, I was incredibly moved. Somebody was being projected by the, essentially a bomb, projecting out into space. It was thrilling. I was weeping. Let me just put it that way. It was incredibly inspiring. And I'll never forget it. And I think that's something that everybody ought to be able to experience. So I'd like to see it continue and develop. The great thing about NASA is basically it's available. It's kind of like the Smithsonian or something. You start finding out what you can have access to. And every one of you can have access. It's beautiful.
Sun Rings continues to evolve as it has from the beginning. Though it wasn't part of composer Terry Riley's original intent, the piece even includes the last person to walk on the moon.
You'll hear the amazing voice of Eugene Cernan, I think he's...
Yes, yeah, Gene Cernan, one of the Apollo astronauts.
Yes. Well, it was Willie Williams that brought that quote into the beginning of One Earth, One People, One Love. And at first, Terry... He thought it was kind of an intrusion. Well, it is an intrusion, but when you hear it, and you listen, and I don't know anything about him, Eugene Cernan.
He commanded one of the Apollo landing missions.
Yes, I knew that. I don't know where he's from, but he sounds to me like he's from the Midwest somewhere. And he sounds like he probably had about 10 cups of coffee right before he said this. And so in your mind, you have to slow this man down a little bit. But if you listen to what he says, it's one of the great prayers that's ever been, that I've ever encountered in my life. It's so beautiful. And he talks about what it's like to turn around and look at the Earth from space. And he talks about the vastness and the blackness and the beauty of this place that we have and how nothing's holding it up. There's no strings, there's no... And he's talking so fast, and you think,
what's going on with this poor guy, you know? But what he says is just miraculous. I love it, and every time I hear it, I'm inspired by it.
Also contributing to the conversation was Alan Shockley of the university's Bob Cole Conservatory of Music. Alan listened with us to a few of Don Granette's sounds and made this observation.
Listening to those sounds, I'm thinking about how music and astronomy have been connected since the beginning, really. This is very, very new, very, very late 20th century, 21st century, to be able to hear the sounds from outer space. But from ancient times, from Pythagoras, we have someone who's theorizing about musical tones in a scale, and at the same time theorizing that there's a similar relationship between the sounds that the planets and the moon and the sun, the heavenly bodies, make.
The music of the spheres?
Music of the spheres, or the harmony of the spheres, as Pythagoras called it. So it's a very old idea that we're only now having the technology to capture. It's kind of bringing music back to its beginning. It's bringing music back to where Plato thought it should be. Astronomy and music for Plato were two sides of the same coin, one appealing to the ears and one appealing to the eyes, but with the same basis. So it's kind of an exciting thing that Kronos is working with Terry Riley to make Plato's vision happen, or Pythagoras' vision happen, from ancient times to now.
Kronos Quartet violinist John Sherba found similar purposes in the efforts of musicians, composers, scientists, and even organizations like the Planetary Society. We all explore.
Ultimately, it's a search. You're searching. And that's kind of what NASA and your organization is doing, continuing being curious and searching.
This has just been delightful. It has been wonderful to sit here with some of my heroes. Alan, thank you so much for being part of this discussion. Please, for Alan Shockley and the Kronos Quartet, let them know how much we've appreciated this. Hope to see all of you tomorrow evening.
A visit with the Kronos Quartet just prior to their performance of Sun Rings by Terry Riley, inspired by and including the space sounds of Don Granette. We thank Michelle Roberge and her staff at the Carpenter Performing Arts Center, Dean of the College of Engineering at California State University Long Beach, Farzan Golshani, and Dean of the College of the Arts, Chris Miles. I'll return with Bruce Betts after we enjoy a few more moments of Sun Rings. It's time for What's Up on Planetary Radio, and that means that we're going to be talking with Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, who comes in each week to tell us about the night sky and maybe give some stuff away. We're going to give away Bill Nye's voice again on somebody's answering machine. Hello, and happy post-Mother's Day.
Hello, and same to you and more of it.
Thank you. What's up there in the sky for Mom?
Bright stuff. We've got Venus starting to get higher and higher after sunset in the west. Still may be a little tough. It's still very low, but you can pick out Jupiter looking super bright in the west shortly after sunset. And over the next 2 or 3 weeks, those two, the two brightest of the planets, are going to get closer and closer as the weeks go on towards the end of the month. So cool sight to see. And then Saturn, still coming up in the east. You can check it out also in the early evening, but look over in the east. It's yellowish and not so bright.
May I just jump in to say that we were visiting Mom out in the Southern California desert. We came out of a movie. There above the mountain ridge was this tiny sliver of the moon. And a ways above that, I believe it was Jupiter. Am I correct?
Yes, you are.
Wow, what a sky. It was just a lovely juxtaposition.
Yes, there's just there will be juxtaposing going on all month.
All right.
All right. This week in space history, it was 40 years ago that Skylab was launched, the first U.S. space station.
And it was quite a space station. It's a shame that we didn't build on that beginning, but now we've got a much bigger one.
Yeah. Okay, we move on to Random Space Fact.
He's back.
Back and better than ever. Cepheid variables, that's what I've got, Matt. But I'm taking antibiotics, and I hope to be better soon. No, Cepheid variables are a certain breed of variable star. Actually, they come in a couple different breeds. But what's really cool about them is people figured out that their brightness is related to how they pulse, how their brightness goes up and down, which is what a variable star is. And so since you can determine its period, that you can then figure out its absolute brightness. And if you know the absolute brightness of something, then you can figure out how far away it is based upon what its apparent brightness is, how bright it looks like in the sky. And the man, the myth, the legend, Edwin Hubble used this, and lots of other people have used it since, to figure out how far away things are in our galaxy and in other nearby galaxies. So they're used as a way to determine distance. And then he tied that to the redshift he was observing and started to develop that whole crazy expansion of the universe theory.
All because of some stars that dimmed and got brighter again. Cepheid variables. Very interesting.
Exactly. And some clever observations.
Fascinating. Thank you. Good one.
Thank you. Let's go on to the trivia contest where I tried to make everyone feel good by bringing up everyone's favorite doublet, the sodium doublet in the visible spectrum. I asked you, what is the center line of the sodium doublet that, for example, is seen as two absorption lines in the visible spectrum of the sun? How'd we do, Matt?
Wow, way to hold down entries, guy.
Yes!
So that was your goal. The most entertaining entry came from David Kaplan, who was completely thrown. At least he tried to give the impression he was. He said, a sodium doublet, isn't that a waistcoat made of sodium? Wrong definition, I think, David.
Yeah, pretty sure. Yeah.
Actually, I think he knows. But no, we did. This was a good week to enter if you took the trouble to look it up, because there must have been a lot of people intimidated. Thanking you for all of this is our winner this week, Vojtech Navilek from the Czech Republic.
Cool.
Vojtech said that the answer ranges from 588.9950 to 589.5924 nanometers. Or I hope, he says, this one was a tough question, unquote. But I think he got it, right?
Yeah, it's he gives quite, you know, pretty good range variability. But yeah, that's ballpark. It's, you know, ballpark 589 nanometers. Yellow stuff. 589.29 is what I have, but he's got that range. Let's go with the winner and get Bill's voice into the Czech Republic.
By the way, Vojtech does say they had a great show and podcast. He listens to it anytime he can. Car, walking, it's nice to know. You can be walking along there in the Czech Republic and be enjoying Planetary Radio. We also heard from Randy Bodum of Ontario, Canada. He got it right. He also mentioned that it's also known as the Fraunhofer D line.
Yeah.
He says he's partial, though, to the redder C line of hydrogen alpha, smiley face.
Oh, well, that one is nice, but I just enjoy the sound of the Fraunhofer D line.
All right. So what do you got for next week?
Something totally different. Who was the only astronaut to fly on consecutive missions? This being a NASA astronaut to fly on consecutive NASA missions. go to planetary.org/radio contest and enter the contest. And what are they trying to win, Matt?
Bill Nye's voice on your answering system. I hope everybody understands that Bill customizes this message for you. We let you take a first stab at it, do a first draft. And he has great fun doing these for people. Oh, by the way, those are due to us on the 20th of May. That'd be May 20, Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific time.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about the thickest book you have ever read. Thank you, and good night.
Does the Yellow Pages count? I haven't finished it. I thought I'd wait for the movie.
If you finish it, then it counts. Otherwise, no.
He's Bruce Betts, the director of projects for the Planetary Society, and he does join us each week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the harmonious members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies and sweet sounds.
I've noticed something interesting about society and culture. Everything risky requires a license. So learning to drive, owning a gun, getting married. There's a certain... That's true in everything risky except technology. For some reason, there's no standard syllabus. There's no basic course. They just sort of give you your computer and then kick you out of the nest. You're supposed to learn this stuff how? Just by osmosis. Nobody ever sits down and tells you this is how it works. So today, I'm going to tell you 10 things that you thought everybody knew, but it turns out they don't. All right, first of all, on the web, when you're on the web and you want to scroll down, don't pick up the mouse and use the scroll bar. That's a terrible waste of time. Do that only if you're paid by the hour. Instead, hit the space bar. The space bar scrolls down one page. Hold down the shift key to scroll back up again. So spacebar to scroll down one page works in every browser on every kind of computer. Also on the web, when you're filling in one of these forms, like your addresses, I assume you know that you can hit the tab key to jump from box to box to box. But what about the pop-up menu where you put in your state? Don't open the pop-up menu. That's a terrible waste of calories. Type the first letter of your state over and over and over. So if you want Connecticut, go CCC. If you want Texas, go TT, and you jump right to that thing without even opening the pop-up menu. Also on the web, when the text is too small, what you do is hold down the control key and hit plus, plus, plus. You make the text larger with each tap. It works on every computer, every web browser, or minus, minus, minus to get smaller again. If you're on the Mac, it might be Command instead. When you're typing on your BlackBerry, Android, iPhone, don't bother switching layouts to the punctuation layout to hit the period and then a space and then try to capitalize the next letter. Just hit the space bar twice. The phone puts the period, the space, and the capital for you. Go space, space. It is totally amazing. Also, when it comes to cell phones, on all phones, if you want to redial somebody that you've dialed before, all you have to do is hit the call button, and it puts the last phone number into the box for you. And at that point, you can hit call again to actually dial it. So you don't need to go into the recent calls list. So if you're trying to get through to somebody, just hit the call button again. Here's something that drives me crazy. When I call you and leave a message on your voicemail, I hear you saying, leave a message. And then I get these 15 seconds of frickin' instructions like we haven't had answering machines for 45 years. I'm not bitter. So it turns out there's a keyboard shortcut that lets you jump directly to the beep like this. Unfortunately, the carriers didn't adopt the same keystroke. So it's different by carrier. So it devolves upon you to learn the keystroke for the person you're calling. I didn't say these were going to be perfect. OK. So most of you think of Google as something that lets you look up a web page, but it is also a dictionary. Type the word define, and then the word you want to know. You don't even have to click anything. There's the definition as you type. It's also a complete FAA database. Type the name of the airline in the flight. It shows you where the flight is, the gate, the terminal, how long till it lands. You don't need an app for that. It's also a unit and currency conversion. Again, you don't have to click one of the results. Just type it into the box, and there's your answer. While we're talking about text, when you want to highlight, this is just an example. When you want to highlight a word, please don't waste your life dragging across it with the mouse like a newbie. Double-click the word. Watch 200. I go double-click. It neatly selects just that word. Also, don't delete what you've highlighted. You can just type over it. This is in every program. Also, you can go double-click drag to highlight in one-word increments as you drag. Much more precise. Again, don't bother deleting. Just type over it. Shutter lag is the time between your pressing the shutter button and the moment the camera actually snaps. It's extremely frustrating on any camera under $1,000. So that's because the camera needs time to calculate the focus and exposure. But if you pre-focus with a half press, leave your finger down, no shutter lag. You get it every time. I've just turned your $50 camera into a $1,000 camera with that trick. And finally, it often happens that you're giving a talk, and for some reason the audience is looking at the slide instead of at you. So when that happens, this works in Keynote, PowerPoint, it works in every program. All you do is hit the letter B key, B for blackout, to black out the slide, make everybody look at you, and then when you're ready to go on, you hit B again. And if you're really on a roll, you can hit the W key for whiteout, and you white out the slide, and then you can hit W again to unblank it. So I know I went super fast. If you missed anything, I'll be happy to send you the list of these tips. In the meantime, congratulations. You all get your California technology license. Have a great day.